radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5. Centuries of deep coal mining in Britain has come to an end today with the closure of the last remaining pit, Kellingley Colliery in North Yorkshire. Elizabeth Williams reports.
The miners clocked off at lunchtime. 450 of them have lost their jobs.
If I could do it all again, I'd do it again.
You won't get a better place to work in. Everybody is your mate.
We've done it for 40 years, it's a long time.
Paul Novak from the TUC is accusing the government of industrial vandalism.
The fact is, we will still have coal-fired power stations till 2025.
Labour MP Yvette Cooper says it's a huge loss for the community.
So many of us round here have coal in our blood.
The last haul of coal from today will go on display at a local museum.
Police have questioned the pilot involved in the Shoreham air crash, which killed 11 people in August. Andy Hill voluntarily went to a police station. £520 million will be paid out to those whose homes were flooded during Storm Desmond earlier this month. Insurance companies say £2.5 million of emergency payments have already been made. Sarah Cordy from the Association of British Insurers says what the money will be used for.
Warm clothes, that's salaries for staff if the business has been taken out of action. That's things for them to get on with their lives as quickly as they can. But what insurers are also paying for is safe, warm, dry accommodation for them to live in while their homes are repaired.
Npower has been fined £26 million for failing to treat complaints and billing issues fairly. More than 500,000 customers are affected, with some in line to get compensation. A video has been released by the UK's top police officers to show people what they should do in the event of a Paris-style terror attack. It gives three main instructions: to run if it's safe, to hide if it's not, and to call the police when you can. And the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have announced from the nursery that Prince George is to attend from January. He'll go to the Westacre Montessori School Nursery in Norfolk. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
You've been so good to me.
BCFM. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Foder. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, journalist and author who's won a tribunal victory for our privacy is here to tell all from the courtroom where even the press were excluded. Plus the death of the fascist Grand Master of Italian Freemasonry, the lodge that controlled Italy, this week. Also, we expand the facts behind the so-called mystery of P2 master Licio Gelli, who died this week, aged 96. And revelations in the Daily Mirror about 200 years of Freemasonry ruling the British Empire. Also, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, tonight, lows of 14, windy with light showers, yes, mild again. This weekend, highs of 15 Celsius, wet and windy on Saturday, cooler with some sunny spells on Sunday. Temperatures next week, around 14 degrees Celsius still. It really is December, is it? Windy with some sunny spells and showers. Next weekend, 26th and 27th of December, highs of 7 Celsius, fairly sunny next week over Christmas, but a little bit cooler. Certainly not as cool as you'd normally expect this time of year, though. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Foder. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, good evening.
Now, you are a Green Councillor. You have been for a little while now, and I know you came in and talked back in May, really, in the run-up to the local elections.
That's right. Yes.
What's this, how is the Green Party doing on the City Council now?
Well, it's been remarkable success, I'd say, this year. We started with six councillors prior to the local elections, and then after that, we've risen till there are 14 of us now, the third largest group on the City Council.
And we've had last week, the full council meeting?
That's right, on Tuesday.
What were you up to there?
Well, I presented what's called the Golden Motion, and to put it simply, once or twice a year, each party group gets a guaranteed debate on the subject of their choice. And we had a good discussion in our group, and I put forward a motion to lobby the Avon Pension Fund, which is the fund for the workforce of all the local authorities in the former Avon area across the west of England, to ask it to be fossil fuel free, to get the stocks out of fossil fuel shares and into diversification in renewable energy, energy efficiency and so on.
So do you know what investments that we do have for our staff of our city in those shares?
Sure. Well, the pension fund has a whole range of investments, and in fact, from what I understand, its relatively small proportion is in sort of companies that are mainly involved in fossil fuel extraction.
So how open are they about exactly what they're investing in? Because, I mean, they could be investing in arms firms and all sorts.
Very likely. All the major types of investment, they will have investment. In fact, today at a scrutiny commission, we speculate on the fact there will be investments in major house builders, and we're not happy how the house builders are reacting to development opportunities in Bristol, for instance, the lack of affordable housing they're offering in their developments.
But is there any opportunity to use that shareholding to say to the house builders, we want you to do this and that, or maybe even to get your own person on the board?
Well, that's right. In terms of the pension fund, we have one representative, although 40% of the fund is from Bristol's previous and current employees. And so we have a voice, but we can also influence the fund. The trade union have a voice, and Unison were a great supporter of my motion. Well, they themselves came forward with a proposal to get out of fossil fuel investments as well. So they were active in the recent council meeting on Tuesday.
So how did it go?
It went well. We succeeded in a majority, 41-4 and 16 against what we call divestment and diversification. It was amended. Both the Lib Dems and Labour decided it was a great motion, they'd like to support it, but they'd like to change it, and basically weakened it a bit, but we still got through with a majority, and the mayor committed to taking that message to the Avon Pension Fund on behalf of the City Council.
So he's going to take the message now. Yes, is he actually going to do anything?
Yes, we hope so. I mean, all he can do as well is influence, but he can have a constructive conversation, and he can join. I suggested he join with the trade union, talk to the other local authorities themselves. One of the statements in support of my motion was, in fact, from a councillor from Bath North East Somerset, whose own council pension will be partly invested, in that same pension fund. So it's about influence, and it's about proposing both constructive engagement, which is what you were talking about, influencing the investments we already have, plus proposing very practical ways of diversifying away from fossil fuels and into the technologies that are so important for our future, both our economy and the enterprise and the engineering skills of Bristol, which are in renewable energy nowadays.
But this whole idea of the Avon area is not gone away, has it? Because they're now talking about a city region. Mm. I think I first heard this from Business West. They wanted this years ago. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they were behind the original idea of Avon, which was then rejected, wasn't it? But is this going to happen? Are we going to have a kind of metro mayor for Bath, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, it's quite likely, because the government wants it to happen, that they will effectively require us to have a joint way of managing things like economic development, transport and housing development.
You know what, if I was a ruthless politician up in Westminster, I'd say, well, we'll tell them they can't have any money unless they do this.
That's effectively what they're saying. They say, if you want greater say over the funds that are made available to this region from central government largely, then you must have some elected or representative way of representing, say, Bristol, South Gloucester, North Somerset.
But we do that already, don't we, with councillors like you?
Well, we have the city council, and clearly we try to influence that. But a lot of decisions should be taken on a greater Bristol basis. I think we've always known that. Avon, as a county, which had the four current local authorities all in it, basically had the ideal area for a transport authority, because over 98% of all the commuting in the Avon area was within the Avon area and didn't go beyond the boundaries. So what better zone to manage commuter traffic and transport problems?
Yeah, I suppose there's not that many people who live in Bristol and work in Taunton or maybe in Gloucester.
It's much smaller.
It's a bit, that's a
so
sort of natural
all the journeys,
area.
Almost all those journeys, and yet we have no say over the bus network, no say over the management of the road network, no say over the rail network. We have to cooperate great to get funds for cycling across the boundaries. Greater Bristol Bus Network crosses the boundary, so we actually have to cooperate.
But they do this with county councils, unitary authorities, don't they, where several councillors from one smaller council will go to make up a body which... Well, you don't have to have one mayor. Surely you could have a group of councillors which reflects the political diversity of the city that was as part of this new city region.
I'd certainly want it to reflect the political... as you call it, the political diversity, the mix. Ideally on a proportional basis, because at the moment it's all on a first past the post basis, which isn't exactly representative. But the other thing is, we also need to have ways of accountability, scrutiny, and it's very, very weak across the West of England. Increasingly, funds have been given to the Local Enterprise Partnership and the West of England decision making without almost any scrutiny.
No, that's right, isn't it? They're very cheeky, actually. When I spoke to their press people from the Local Enterprise Partnership, they were saying, oh, well, no, the Local Enterprise Partnership doesn't spend any public money.
But it sends decisions.
A little letter up to Westminster and says this is where we want you to spend it, and that's what they do.
And they design the local economic strategy for the West of England.
And they're also quite good at giving money to themselves, to the different organisations who are on the board of the Local Enterprise Partnership.
Well,
we're kind of disappearing away from democracy here, really. You know, Martin, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, there's another thing about this Metro Mayor which occurs to me, is if we're going to be including areas like North Somerset, South Gloucestershire, etc., these are pretty much hard and fast Tory areas, it's going to mean it's much more likely that a metro mayor for the whole area is going to be a Tory.
Well, that's possible. I mean, the political diversity in the Avon region is greater than, say, on Merseyside, for example, which is where they've been talking about, you know, the Northern Powerhouse and all the rest of it. But I think that's possibly what will wreck it, because there's going to be a lot of opposition from, you know, the Tory voting rural areas around Bristol to having anything run from Bristol. I mean, even though it makes a lot of sense to have a city region, lots of people are rather stuck in the mud about it.
Well, George Ferguson is certainly... there's another advert for him in the Bristol Post today. Or should I say article, editorial. Looks like another George advert. Tweet, tweet, George Ferguson is the best council leader when it comes to social media. Yeah, so almost cut and paste from George's public relations people, it looks like. But it doesn't actually say it's an advert on here. George does seem to have quite a lot of sympathy from, particularly from the Bristol Post. Why do you think that is, Martin?
Well, I can't be exactly sure, but one thing is certain. He has raised the profile of leadership, and there is at least some academic work that says people didn't know who ran things or who led things before, and now they do. Whether they agree with him is another matter, but we know who's representing the city. We know who's speaking for the city internationally, nationally, and so on. And you could say he's doing a good job. He's getting Bristol heard about. He's drawing attention to it and the projects here. So that's not a bad thing.
Well, also, social media costs, doesn't it? Because, I mean, I'm sure it certainly isn't George that's sitting there 24/7 doing all these tweeting. He's got people working with him helping him. You know, basically even teaching him what the best way to do is to use it. I mean, is there a fairly fair split between the different parties as how much money they've got to spend on this kind of thing?
I would have no idea about the spending of the money, I'm afraid.
On PR, because it's actually, isn't it PR that wins elections these days?
I hope it's policies. Most people like Green Party policies. They don't always realise they're Green Party policies, but there's widespread support.
Okay, give us a couple that you think that will win you the Green Mayor next May.
I think for one thing, people believe that we are doing things differently. We're not spending our time criticising and disparaging the others. We're saying what we want to do and what we believe are the policies that should be
carried
out.
Which are? Give us two.
Social housing, local involvement in decision making, local control over transport systems.
Okay. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, let's bring you in again here, because it seems to me that more and more nowadays elections are won and lost on by the media and by the way that almost marketing kind of tactics that are used in the US. I mean, look at what's been going on. I mean, we've still got a while to go now, still, until the US presidential election next year, but it's already hotting up over there. Millions and millions of dollars being spent on one candidate or another.
Well, it's very worrying. I agree with other Martin about PR. Without PR, it's very difficult to, you know, get representative politics going. But of course, resources matter as well. And in the US, the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court means that any amount of money can be spent by anybody on a political campaign, and they don't even have to be transparent about who's spending the money. So you can spend the money, and you can, you know, have a whole propaganda barrage against somebody, which is a lot of what the money spent on is negative campaigning, and you're not even allowed to know who spent the money, which is completely unacceptable. And Bernie Sanders, for example, said he's going to try and get that overturned if he gets anywhere. But of course, in Scandinavia, since World War II, all political parties are funded entirely by the state, and the state proportions of the money depending upon the political party's power at the last election, the share of the vote they got, and it does make a difference. In Britain, we're a bit of a halfway house between the sort of free-for-all of the US and the kind of controlled systems that they have in Scandinavia. I think we're going to have to go down that road eventually, because in the US, the current setup is becoming absolutely absurd, and we're actually going down that road. It's very expensive.
Why
to do it.
Why on earth would either of the two main parties do that, though, Martin? Because they know that they have, with the first-class supposed system, they've got an advantage.
Some of the legislation that's being put through by the current government is designed to undermine the trade union's ability to fund the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Labour Party has survived over a century because it had that institutional financial support from the Labour Party, from the trade union movement. In Germany, the DGB, the trade unions, don't fund the SPD. They keep their own funds for things like strikes and so on. And the SPD is funded by the government, by central government. And I think we've got to get big money out of politics. In the US, this is becoming a major, major issue. But it is absurd that, you know, hedge funds can, fund the Tory party to power and then, for example, say, right, we want you to write legislation which is in favour of hedge funds. And that's blatantly what's going on. And that's got to be put a stop to.
Martin, it might all sound good, but you're trying to persuade voters to pay for you guys. I mean, that's the last thing they want to do, surely.
That may be so, but I think they would also be very concerned that basically big money influences politics and policies, and current government is also in fact proposing cutting is it by 19% the budget for the offices of the political parties.
Yeah.
So effectively weaken every party that hasn't got large external sources of funds. So they're kind of entrenching their advantage, which is very anti-democratic.
Okay, before we go on to listen to some of the Prime Minister's questions, the last one of the year, a huge rise, we hear, in newborn babies who have been subject to care proceedings. Well, that's a polite way of putting it. That means the newborn babies that have been taken away from their mothers at birth. This is a story on Monday. There has been a huge rise in the number of newborns who are subject to care proceedings, according to figures compiled for the first time. Some 2,018 babies were involved in such cases in 2013, compared with 802 in 2008. The University of Lancaster says half of them were taken from mothers with other children in care. One woman had 16 children removed, and a third were for women who became mothers as teens. Education Secretary Nicky Morgan said the figures were worrying. Martin, what's your... which Martin are we going to ask first? Martin Foda from the Green Party. What are your thoughts about this story? Lots and lots of newborn babies mm-hmm. being taken away at birth from their mothers.
Yeah. Well, I'm in fact on the Council's guardianship panel, and when we are guardian to someone, the whole point of that guardianship, I'm not saying it's exactly the same, but the decision is based on what is best for the person you're guardian of. So if this is in the interests of the babies, then that may be good, you know, by definition a good thing, because they've been looking at what risks there are, for instance. And some are from teenage mothers who may not be able to look after children. Some, there's already a track record of children being in care, as you
But what mentioned. If what if you say they may not be able to, but what if they are able to look after those
children? Well, of course, then there needs to be a voice for people to make the case.
So what do? You take the child away on the assumption that they're not, and then the mother then has to argue to have their child back?
I'm not sure the exact procedure, but there must be, or there certainly should be a voice. There could potentially be a social worker, there could be a medical report, there could also be an independent voice, which we have, again, on the council's guardianship panel, we have someone whose only role is to represent the views of the person we're discussing. Now, that tends to be an adult, of course.
But well, when it's so a it's baby, difficult how do you know what the baby's views
are? You will then have to have someone who is purely there to look at the interests of that baby in its immediate future.
Now, there is a bit of a problem here, isn't there, that things like fostering is starting to become, I mean, for example, a lot of ex-social workers have set up fostering agencies where they can make money from fostering these children. Yeah. So the person who's in on your panel might be saying, oh, we think this one should be taken away, just so that their mates or their old mates can make money.
If there's an economic interest in privatising fostering, is worrying.
Martin Summers, what do you make of this?
Well, I would just reiterate that privatising decision-making is bound to create conflicts of interest, and it's just hard to know what's going on here. You know, there's been a hoo-ha in the media this week about the vast increase in people reporting domestic violence, for example. And that clearly doesn't... I think there probably hasn't been a massive uptick in domestic violence. What's happened is quite likely more people are prepared to come forward and report it. In this case, you may find that cases in the past, which they say, well, we're not going to take the children away from the parents because, you know, it's basically a default position. It's the parents to be with. I mean, look at the amount of figures we're talking about. 2018 in the whole country and 800 the previous year.
But that's 2,000 mothers who are screaming for to have their children.
Yeah, but it's
back.
Possible. Yeah, but the children have rights independent of their parents.
Yeah.
And if they've got, and there's got to be some balance struck between the rights of parents to keep children and for children to stay with parents.
But isn't it the obvious thing to do to allow the child to stay with the parents unless there's a problem?
Well, unless they end up dead, Tony, like Baby P, and then everybody screams blue murder.
What you find, I think, is that there are fashions. This could be a sort of statistical blip and it will revert. But there have, over the decades, been a switch to, you know, children care, then no, the parents know best, no, something's gone wrong, back to more care.
There's also a sinister side to this, though, isn't there? Because there's a lot more single mums, particularly in poverty. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of the decisions made are to do with, well, you can't afford to look
after. It could be the ability to provide. It could be due to drug abuse, which may rise in times like this.
Yeah. It's hard to know. I mean, it's hard to make a political... We need to know more about what's going on here before we jump to any firm conclusions.
That's involved in all this, Martin. What's your final words on this one?
Well, I don't know more than I've seen in this story, unfortunately, so I'm not an expert, but we certainly need to know more about the causes and the effects and how the decisions are made.
And actually, that's exactly what they're saying in the article and the interview that was on the BBC Today programme. More studies are needed to determine the reasons for the rise. Vince Cable was one of 40 MPs on the guest list for an arms dealers dinner in London. Now, this is a story from February. How about that? That's not really news, is it? But why is that? Well, because we had a big hoo-ha last Friday, didn't we, about Jeremy Corbyn going to the Stop the War dinner.
That's right. One dinner's okay, but the others are fine if they're funded by weapons companies.
This is a business secretary. He was, as he was at the time. Now, he sort of dances around TV studios. You do rather wonder what he's doing there, thinking that, well, the voters got rid of you, Vince. What are you doing in TV studio again? And why would anyone listen to you? But yes, he was at the speech at the event, also featuring BBC News personality Jeremy Vine. Back in February, the Independent reported, the British government's close ties to the arms industry was illustrated at a London banquet hosted by UK defence and security companies. 40 MPs on the guest list for a £250 a head gathering at the Hilton Hotel on Park Lane, hosted by trade organisation ADS, according to information provided by activist group Campaign Against the Arms Trade. Vince Cable, who was business secretary at the time, was the most high-profile attendee and gave a speech at the event. He was there to address some of the UK's major employers, Martin. We're back to the arms business again, but is this appropriate for government ministers to be going along to things like this?
And well, was he a government minister when he went?
Yeah, he was secretary, business secretary.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't approve of business secretaries going to such events, but you can see why they might end up there, can't you?
And then to moan about the leader of the Labour Party going to a Stop the War dinner.
Well, that's just absurd. But, I mean, the fact is that... the arms industry, I mean, in Bristol in particular, the arms industry is a major employer. And if you were a local MP and you didn't go along to things like this, I don't approve. I mean, there should be a political cost for being associated with the arms trade. And, you know, you can't stop people going, but you can say, well, hang on a minute, you go, then that's a black mark against you. And that's possibly one of the reasons why he's no longer the MP for Twickenham.
Apparently, Jeremy Vine got a five-figure fee for going to the arms fair dinner, and he did a keynote speech for them, Martin.
That's right. After dinner, speakers can command significant fees. And I think the worrying thing is firstly the double standards. Talking about alternatives to war and peace get pilloried in the media, and then going to dinner with the people making money out of the bombs and missiles. That's good business, of course.
Mind you, Jeremy Vine did a superb programme. In fact, he does a lot better in that, in my view, than a lot of Radio 4 programmes on his Radio 2 show, where he had Richard Kemp, the former leader of the British Armed Forces in Afghanistan, Martin, and George Galloway on, talking about Shakarama on Monday, which was pretty damn fiery stuff. Produced, I think, by one of our ex-producers here on BCFM, I do believe. But you know, there is certainly, you know, you can't just judge a book by its cover, by any stretch of the imagination. Okay, so let's have a look now at some of the Westminster stories, particularly going to Wednesday's Prime Minister's questions. And we'll kick off, I think, with the National Health Service. Yet again came up when Jeremy Corbyn put his question.
Mr. Speaker, the number of days that patients are being kept in hospital because there is nowhere safe to discharge them to has doubled since the Prime Minister took office. On the 4th of November, I asked him if he could guarantee there will be no winter crisis in the NHS this winter. He didn't answer then. I wonder if he'd be able to help us with an answer today.
Yes. Well, first of all, let me join the right honourable gentleman and be very clear that I don't want to wish him the season's greetings. I want a full happy Christmas for the right honourable gentleman and everyone in the House. He asked specifically about the NHS, and let me answer specifically about the NHS. The average stay in hospital has actually fallen since I became Prime Minister, from 5.5 days to 5 days. And one of the reasons for that is that we kept our promises on the NHS. We put an extra £12 billion in the last Parliament, and we'll be putting £19 billion in cash terms in the NHS in this Parliament.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Mr. Speaker, just for the record, I did say Happy Christmas.
And you could hear someone saying that he never listens to anything he says. Well, that was a bit of a weird exchange in a way. I mean, leaving the NHS aside for a second, Martin, it was almost Martin Summers. The Prime Minister said, "Oh, I'm going to say a proper Happy Christmas, not season's greetings." It almost seemed scripted because Jeremy Corbyn had said Happy Christmas. Well, that was very strange, and it was like you know, some sort of pre-preparation for Prime Minister's questions that he got completely wrong. He'd been briefed, I think, that Jeremy Corbyn was going to say season's greetings, but he didn't. He said Happy Christmas. Bizarre.
Well, yes, it's sort of shadow boxing, isn't it? I mean, the improvement, I suppose, if we could call it that, in Prime Minister's questions seems to be running out of steam, doesn't it? We're getting back to the same old squabbling point scoring that we used to have before Corbyn tried to improve the tone of it all.
And you're doing very well if you can actually get an answer to a question as well, which is really frustrating. Right. The problem with beds is very real, though, Martin Fodor, I think, isn't it?
Yes, well, and the NHS is under pressure for all sorts of reasons, including the sort of limited funding, which of course is an ideal way to make people think that there might be alternatives like a private health system. But the reality is it's really a very cost-effective system. What worries me, just talking from the local level, is the fact that public health, which is the preventive side of our sort of health and caring system, public health was devolved to local government a couple of years ago, and it's already suffering from the reduced funding available in local government, which is largely from central government. So they've devolved something, the responsibility, but they're now cutting the resources. So we will have less money to spend in and around Bristol to prevent the problems that quite often lead to very expensive things going wrong and people going to hospital.
Yes, some quite bad news as well today. A newborn baby died after a mistake by Bristol Hospital doctors. It seems to be plagued Bristol, doesn't it? And this is from the coroner's report from this baby's death, Martin, by problems with the children's unit at the BRI particularly. But what about this bigger problem of there just being nowhere to discharge patients? After they've been treated, they're sitting in the hospital waiting for somewhere safe to go.
Well, I mean, it's just been pointed out that that's a lot of this social care has been transferred to local authorities and they've not actually been given the resource. The other fundamental problem is the whole NHS trust system and the provider-purchaser split, which in 13 years of Labour government was never reversed. In actual fact, the real success of the NHS is that it's a planned system, that it isn't a market-based system. It's actually explicitly, when it was set up to not to be a market-based system, it's going to be a planned system where we weren't going to get postcode lotteries. And, you know, there is a case for planning things from the top. Not always, and of course there's got to be flexibility. But they've introduced all of this pseudo-market into it. And of course now you're going to have NHS Trust going bankrupt, quite possibly, because of because they can't make the sums add up. And then what do you do? Well, the central government will have to step in and bail them out, as they did with Southern Cross, the care homes. And we've just got used to this idea that this kind of pseudo market is inevitable, and it's not. It's just stupid, and there's no reason why we should do it. But as I say, 13 years of Labour government, and they didn't do anything to end
it. So, what is the reason? You say there's no reason, but there must be.
The reason is that we've got a lack of imagination. The changes that were made in things like NHS management in the 80s are treated as irreversible by many people in mainstream politics. And that's what's wrong with mainstream politics, is we can't actually have a proper debate. And the case for a planned National Health Service, which is not a pseudo-market, hasn't been coherently made by anybody really in the last 20 years. And I'm afraid the Greens in this because of their obsession with decentralisation.
We're in favour of publicly run.
Well, I know, I'm not trying to have a cheap shot sure. there, but I think as a socialist I want to make the case for a planned system. It's actually cheaper. The reason why Britain has the most cost effective system in the world is because it's the most planned system, where you have more insurance involved than pseudo markets. The expense goes up to it, so you finally end up with what's happened in the US, where the new system of compulsory private healthcare, it looks like pretty much of a shambles from this side of the water.
Okay, on to our next clip from Prime Minister's Questions, and this is about the closure of the Kettingley Colliery in Yorkshire, the last deep mine coal in the whole of Britain, and it's Nigel Adams, I think, putting the question to the Prime Minister, David Cameron.
Nigel Adams!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This Friday sadly sees the closure of Britain's last deep coal mine at Kellingley in my constituency. Will my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, join me in thanking the hundreds of workers who will be working their last shift this Friday, and also praise the thousands of workers whose bravery and hard graft over the last 50 years has helped warm our homes, power our factory and keep our lights on?
I think my honourable friend speaks very strongly for his constituents, and I'm very happy to join him in thanking people who've worked so hard at that mine and elsewhere. And obviously it is a difficult time, and as part of the closure process, the government has put nearly £18 million to ensure that the workers receive the same package as the miners that recently closed Thoresby. And that finance has allowed the mine to keep on. It's all very well. Honourable members opposite shouting. Can I just tell them something? Right? Can I just tell them something?
Taking on the role of a speaker here.
Right, this is the official policy of the Labour Party. Just right. We must take action to keep fossil fuels in the ground. Right? That is their policy. Right? They've also got a policy, by the way, of reopening coal mines. So presumably what they're going to do is dig a big hole in the ground and then sit there and do nothing. Yeah. What a metaphor for his leadership of his party.
Well, that's again, it's just, it started off with everybody trying to agree and then it turned into knockabout. People have got to remember, we're still going to be using coal in this country, but it's going to be coming from places like Colombia. And I've been to Colombia on a trade union delegation 10 years ago. The coal mines in Colombia are great big strip mines. The Carajás mine is a 9-mile wide hole in the ground, which displaced thousands of indigenous people who used to live in where the mine is, and just basically is strips and the trade unions who are working inside the mine are trying to get adequate compensation for the people who were displaced by the mine. That's where coal will now come from, instead of from South Yorkshire, where, you know, over many generations the wages and conditions were improved from the very dangerous job that mining used to be.
As a Green, Martin Fodor, I imagine you're quite happy about this mine being closed.
Yeah. There are two completely separate things which we need to bear in mind. One is, if coal still gets burned, which I don't agree with, where does it come from and how safe is that, and what's the environmental impact? So that's one question. The second one is, how do we look after the people who were mining, and how do we switch to new green jobs that actually provide the energy for the future? And we need coherent policies, the opposite of what the government's doing, but policies that invest in renewables and the transition to a cleaner energy economy.
So yes or no to coal? Is this a good day or not?
Well, as the other Martin said, if we're still burning coal, then it's just coming from somewhere else. So the jobs have been exported, as has the pollution and the safety issues.
So should they not close this coal and this instead say they could keep this coal mine open, yeah, and not import the coal?
The closure of one particular mine, this final deep mine, and we still have open cast mines which have all sorts of impacts too, the closure of any one mine is due to where the buying and selling of coal, the economics of buying and selling coal. The fact that we need to shut down coal power stations, which actually the Energy Secretary did restate recently, what that means is we do need a strategy for new technology, green jobs and so on, and of course the Green Party has that strategy.
And nuclear, of course, that's what the government's saying.
Subsidise nuclear.
Nuclear is replacing this. That's what they're saying.
Well, they think so, but at the moment they're not offering enough of a subsidy to the French and Chinese governments to come and actually build any nuclear, of course. I don't think it'll happen.
To what extent, Martin, is this all just being run by the oil industry and the big energy companies like Shell, those kinds of people?
Well, there are all sorts of factors involved. I mean, as we've just been pointing out, I mean, the nuclear power industry requires massive government subsidy. And if that subsidy were spent, you know, what you want to do is manage the decline of the coal industry. So, for example, what we had during the great strike of 84-85 was that, as Arthur Scargill said, they're not just going to take away the uneconomic pits. They want to destroy the whole industry for basically reasons of political spite. And trying to manage this decline is very important. What makes me not laugh, but sort of snort, really, is that these miners that both sides of the House of Commons are saying what wonderful chaps they are, next week they're going to be feckless scroungers, aren't they, who can't get their act together and get a job and need to be sanctioned and what have you. And of course, that's the way of it, isn't it?
Well, I mean, this is a massive problem, isn't it, for the north of England. Martin Fodor, there's lots of communities over there over the last 20, 30 years who have found that, well, there's an enormous town, city, built around many of these mining areas.
That's right.
That have just completely lost their reason to be there. And lots of boarded up homes, very little, yeah, if any.
That's very distressing, and the impact on the communities, the people, their health, their well-being, is horrendous, and very different from kind of this region in the sense, this city. But the fact that there are other resources, there are renewable energy resources, there is investment in energy efficiency
in
homes,
haven't they, in Yorkshire? Quite a lot of wind.
There are lots of potential engineering and construction and energy efficiency jobs. A million green jobs is one of the slogans of the People's Assembly Against Austerity, because there's work that needs to be done for people, for their homes, for their communities. And in this region, our MEP, Molly Scott-Cato, has commissioned a report that demonstrates the southwest of England region could more than generate enough energy, all types of energy, heat and power, for all our energy needs. We could become an exporter of that and a powerhouse of jobs. And it's the neglect of that investment and the undermining of solar and wind and tidal power and so on that are actually taking jobs away and taking control of our energy away.
Martin Summers, we're now potentially, anyway, getting very close to fighting with the Russians over in Syria. Certainly, you know, with airplanes whizzing around. And so there seems to be a struggle, anyway, for control of the government of Syria, the state of Syria, with the Russians wanting Assad to stay and us wanting regime change. What if the Russians say, well, we're not going to sell you any more coal, and then they send a submarine into the Atlantic to sink one of the ships that's coming over with Colombian coal?
Well, it's not. It's actually more. The Syrian war is more about oil and gas pipelines, yeah, actually. There's two competing schemes to move oil and gas
through
Syria.
Well, that's over in the Middle East. What about Russian coal? Can we rely on the supply?
Well, no, but there's actually a lot of Russia. Russia's got some coal, I understand. I'm not a big expert on the coal industry. I would argue that if you're going to... some coal is going to continue to be used. You can't make steel without coal,
imports,
for example.
We're now reliant on imports.
Yeah, exactly. But even if we were to have a green technological revolution, which I'm all in favour of, you're still going to need steel to build your windmills and so on. You're going to need coal. Coal is actually a very useful, very precious thing, and it should be managed in a long-term way. You should think about, well, what are we going to do with our reserves of coal so that we can achieve the goals we want to achieve?
Can we rely on the imports we're now reliant on?
Well, no. We can't, well, ultimately, that is a very big question. Can we rely on food imports, for example? Can we rely on anything like that in the long run? And the answer is probably no. And in a way, it doesn't make a lot... I mean, it's only because the oil price is so low and the transport costs are so low that it makes it economic to bring coal, which is very bulky, from across the Atlantic, which is 10,000 kilometres.
Luckily, the oil price is going down through the floor, isn't it, Martin? So it must be cheaper and cheaper to bring this stuff in.
At the moment, but what we know is at least three quarters of fossil fuels need to stay in the ground, not be drilled, not be mined, but otherwise we're irreversibly affecting the climate. So what we need is a transition, and we need an ambitious program right now. And the undermining of energy efficiency and renewable energy, new forms of heat and power, which is what we basically need, sources of heat, sources of power. And this region has immense resources of all sorts. They're being neglected at the moment by government policy.
But what's going on with the oil price, Martin Summers? Because we've also seen this week new lows in the stock market. I think it was Tuesday hit new lows, and also new highs in house prices. The average house price in Britain this week hit £300,000. What's going on with oil prices and the economy? Everything, all the indicators seem to say, oh, everything's going fine. But then if people aren't buying oil, the oil price is going through the floor, things aren't looking good, are they?
Well, it's basically smoke and mirrors, to use a very old-fashioned phrase. I mean, things like house price rises actually feed through into what looks like a growing economy, but it's all on paper, and in actual practice, we're reaching a turning point possibly where there's going to be another crash. And of course, the stock.
You've been saying that.
Well, I've been saying yes,
now?
But it only happens once. It only happens once, doesn't it?
All of the factors
that lead to a crash are there. And there's no doubt about that. And anybody who says otherwise is just talking through their hat. It's quite... A crash, when it comes, when not if, will only happen once by definition. These kind of catastrophic things happen once in a generation. And it's going to be a rough ride. And hopefully out of that will come the changes we need for a more sustainable, fair world. But you can't bet the farm on that.
Could you just explain why house prices would be going up whilst the stock exchange is going down and the oil price is going down?
Well, because what happens is there's all this funny money floating around, isn't there, that's been created through quantitative easing and low interest rates, and it's got to go somewhere. And it isn't going into investment in the future. Investment is on the floor. It's going into speculative investments, including speculative investments in property and housing, which is the only speculative investment which most people ever engage in. But there's plenty of other speculative investments going on, and it's not filtering through into a genuinely investment-led recovery here or anywhere else. And that's because the system is broken, completely broken. And we had, since the last crash, we've had years to try and get to grips with it and reform it, and the vested interests involved have been much too powerful, and now it's too late, frankly. I don't think there's much point discussing reforming the existing financial system. It's going to reform itself through a catastrophic reset.
Well, I'll ask the same question to you, Martin Foda, from the Green Party, after we've heard a bit more from Prime Minister's questions. It's on a related topic, that is to say, the EU. And will David Cameron get his a four-year exception to having in-work benefits for migrants, which just seems amazing to me, that he expects people to come to this country and then live below, well below, the poverty line and not be entitled to any benefits at all? So let's see what David Cameron, before he went off to the conference, was had to say about that to Angus Robertson from the SNP.
Angus Robertson!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We were reminded this week that there's a very strong majority in Scotland to remain within the European Union. And the Prime Minister has failed. I know his side doesn't like to hear it, but the Prime Minister has failed to give any guarantees that Scotland won't be forced out of the EU by the rest of the UK. Does he have any idea of the consequences of taking Scotland out of the EU against the wishes of voters in Scotland?
This is a United Kingdom, and this is a United Kingdom issue. What I would say to him is, why is he so frightened of listening to the people and holding this historic referendum passed through both these Houses of Parliament in the last week? I say, get a good deal for Britain and then trust the people.
Martin Foda, well, you might not necessarily want to answer for the Scots on this one, but the primary question here is it right to be arguing, I suppose, for 4 years of no benefits, in-work benefits included, to anybody from the EU that comes to Britain? Quite understandably, with the free movement of labour that they like, the European Union is saying, no, we're not having it.
The interesting thing is it's always presented as being people from other countries coming here that might claim benefits. But there are a lot of people from this country who've chosen to live in a whole range of countries across the European Union who equally are entitled to claim benefits. I'd like to know if they think there should be one rule for them and another for the people coming here.
Martin?
The government just done a study of their own, which pointed out that the reason why people come here is not for benefits anyway. It's because they get higher wages and the opportunity to develop their skills. And in any case, if the people, say for example, people are entitled to working tax credit when they come here, that means that they're going to be working for less than locals, which means that locals will then have pressure on their wages to be cut to the same level as the third class citizens from Poland and Bulgaria who will be working alongside them. And of course, it's not going to happen. It's quite clear the other European countries are not going to allow Britain to have an opt-out on this, and therefore we may decide to leave. But if we leave, of course, we'll still have to pay into the EU budget, as Norway and Switzerland do, probably more than we pay in now, because that's the way it works if you want to stay as part of the single European market. None of this has been discussed by any of the anti-EU politicians. We've had UKIP people on here who don't seem to understand that if you leave the EU, you've still got to pay into the EU budget, but you don't get any say over how that money is spent. That's what the Norwegians do. They pay more per head into the EU budget than we do, but they don't get any of that money spent in Norway, and they don't get to say how it's spent. And if you really want to be out of the EU, you can be, but that's the price.
But, I mean,
we'll have to raise taxes on all those who voted in favour of leaving the EU to pay for their pet project.
Interesting though, isn't it, that the Swiss and the Norwegians seem to be doing quite nicely, thank you very much, outside the EU, Martin Foda.
Well, they are a number of ways, but they're not helping write the rules of the market, the various regulations and so on.
So you lose
a voice.
Those rules are being written by the European Commission, which isn't even elected. These guys like Donald Tusk that turn up on the telly and tell us all about this you know, what's happening with
that's
the EU.
Right. The commissioners are appointed by the member states, but of course they are selected by the member states, and Britain has chosen a certain number of people to represent the interests of the City of London and so on in the Commission.
So there has been a bit of news from these negotiations today. EU leaders have offered David Cameron what they call a limited emergency break, allowing Britain to stop migrants claiming benefits if they can be proved to be harming public services. What on earth do you think they mean by that, Martin?
Well, they're trying to find a form of words to keep him happy, basically. But, I mean, a single market is a single market. It implies, you know, you can't have one set of rules for Britain and another set of rules for somebody else, as has just been pointed out. And, of course, the political implications for Scotland are clear, as was made clear in the clip. And, they may decide, well, we don't want to leave. And that really puts the case for independence for Scotland from Westminster as, it's a slam dunk in those cases.
Yeah, I mean, it's something weird going on with the EU. Did the Green Party support the EU, generally speaking, Martin?
Generally speaking, we want to work within the EU. It needs to be reformed. It certainly shouldn't just be a market. The social chapter, the environmental protections are really important for all of us.
But Juncker,
we want to reform how it's
this
run.
This guy Juncker, who is talked about as the president of Europe, nobody's ever elected him. He's a commissioner. He's effectively a civil servant.
No, I mean, it could be democratised, clearly. That's one of the issues. It's remained in the direct hands of the member state ruling governments.
And if
basically,
we look at where a lot of this policy comes from, that we're now instituting as law here in Britain, it's via this rather nasty jellyfish-type body called the European Roundtable of Industrialists, which are big multinational corporations. In fact, I remember, bless you, Martin Summers, I remember seeing some plan to do with Europe's roads and a road-building programme for Europe.
The Trans-European Network.
Which had actually been put together by one of the big construction firms.
I think the worrying thing.
And then just an EU logo put onto the top of it. This is effectively where a lot of this policy is coming from, just multinational corporations that aren't, some of them aren't even mainly European, some of them are partly US corporations.
Well, of course, the sort of global corporations have a great interest in shaping a single market the way that suits them and democratising it, giving a greater role for cities and regions, which is an important but very minor, currently minor part of the European decision-making, the Committee of the Regions, where my colleagues in the European Green Party who are running cities and regions in many of the countries of Europe, their voice could be stronger, and we would have more grassroots, more localism, if you want to call it that. So it certainly shouldn't be purely in the hands of the corporation. But our own government has sent people over to Europe to teach them privatisation policy and things like that after the 80s. That was done by the Tories and then Labour.
It seems European bureaucrats, Martin Summers, are actually slightly more reasonable when it comes to making sure there's basic standards for everybody across the continent than our elected Conservative government here.
Well, the real contradiction is, it's been pointed out, that the European Commission is still in place because the member states do not want a European-wide democracy, like the European Parliament, for example, to decide things. And don't forget, the European parliamentary elections, the turnout is often very, very low. So there's actually, questions of legitimacy and mandate there. The real problem, frankly, whether in or out of the EU, is that the international financial system, dominated as it is by bailed out to big to fail banks and all the rest of it, is in a terminal state. And frankly, whether we are in or out of the EU will make very little difference when we come to the crunch, which is coming very soon, quite possibly before we get to vote on whether we want to be part of this club or not.
Well, before Christmas, this is the last Prime Minister's questions before Christmas, it was nice to see a question all about, in a way, the whole Christmas message. So that was from Gerald Howarth, Conservative MP.
Mr. Speaker, as we approach the festival marking the birth of Jesus
Christ... Order, there was some notably eccentric gesticulation taking place from you, Mr. McNeil, but you should desist.
Calm yourself, man. Go and celebrate if you wish, but we must hear the Honourable Gentleman, and he will be heard. Sir Gerald Howarth.
Mr. Speaker, as we approach the festival marking the birth of Jesus Christ, may I invite the Prime Minister to send out a message of support to those millions of fellow Christians around the world who are suffering persecution. And I also invite him once again to remind the British people that we are a country fashioned by our Christian heritage, and it is that heritage which has resulted in our giving refuge to so many of other faiths over so many centuries, but that we will not tolerate those who abuse our freedom to try to inflict their alien and violent fashions upon us, particularly in the name of Islam.
Well, first of all, let me join him in saying that we should do everything we can to defend and protect the rights of Christians to practice their faith the world over, and that is an important part of our foreign policy. And let me commend also Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, for the excellent work that he does on that basis. Look, I believe that, yes, Britain is a Christian country, and the fact that we have an established faith and we understand the faith, the place of faith in our national life, makes us a more tolerant nation and better able to accommodate other faith groups in our country. And that's why, as I said earlier in this session, I think we should be proud of the fact that this is one of the most successful multi-ethnic, multi-faith, multi-religion democracies anywhere in the world, and that is not in conflict with our status as a predominantly Christian country. I think it's one of the reasons why we've done it.
Interesting, Martin Summers, that it's the Conservative Party that sort of pushed the Christian message much more than Labour, but not necessarily sticking to its morals.
Well, no, my parents are both very active in the Church of England, and I have to tell you that many people active in the Church of England find the current government rather abhorrent in many of its social policies. So they're not... If the Church of England was ever the Conservative Party at prayer, that's long ago gone. And what makes me quite sickened, actually, about this is that in Syria, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, was on the French TV to 2013, mentioning what had happened in 2009, where he was approached by British officials who said, we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. And that links into the fact that the Christian communities in Syria, well, the leaders of those communities...
Those officials were around under a Labour government.
Yes,
hang on a minute, Martin.
Yes, indeed. Indeed they were.
I'm going to give Martin Foda a chance to respond to the Prime Minister's question we just heard.
Well, yes, using one religion for sort of one reason, but ignoring its social messages is very convenient.
Okay, let's wind up anyway with talking about fracking, because we've had this horrific situation where a statutory instrument has been used this week on the last day of Parliament, when most of the MPs weren't even there, force through this this whole business of fracking in national parks. Almost unbelievable. Also this week as well, the law's been changed so nuclear waste dumps can be forced on local communities.
That's right. I mean, it's a travesty of democracy. Very hypocritical to say we need the government to push through fracking, to break its own promise about fracking in national parks, and to push through nuclear waste dumps on and force them on local communities. But at the same time saying, actually, of course, you need a say if there's a wind farm being proposed in the area. So you can have localism, but only when it suits the central government policy to undermine renewables but promote nuclear and fossil fuels.
Is there any real future for fracking? Because the oil price is tumbling, isn't it?
No, it's crashing. And in the USA, the assets are now crashing in value. I mean, I think it's almost passed before it's got here, which is good news, arguably.
Yeah. Maybe this is just a desperate last attempt say, well, maybe there is some sort of future for fracking.
Squeezing the last bit of fossil fuels.
Anyway, time for now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guests, at Screen Councillor for Redland, Martin Foda.
You're welcome.
After the news, journalists and authors won a tribunal victory for our privacy, and he's here, Kevin Carhill, to tell all from the courtroom where even the press were excluded.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an